It's a pleasure to be here again. It's been a few years since I've read at Greenbelt, and it's very good to be back. Apologies in advance to the visual arts queue who suddenly find themselves in a poetry reading. You didn't expect this, did you? Okay, I'm going to be reading entirely from this new collection, Dry Psalter. And I'll say a bit more about how that title came about and what it means in a minute. But I always think you should kick off with a poem before you do too much other talking. This is called Excise Me. So shattered is my heart from endless pounding at my chest wall to get out, that I give in one summer dawn and cut, then lift it. Cupped in my hands like a half-caught bird, it cools and stills. I place it on the sill to keep it warm and lie down on my bed to take stock of this new thoracic calm. Hours pass, then weeks. The sun through glass dries my heart into a peach stone. Another day, I think, just one more, to be sure I will recall this stasis so deep I can hear huge clouds of blind fish under ice sheets, spiders in the leaf mold of distant forests, your thoughts. So Dry Psalter, it's a word, happily I can report, that's just been cut from the Oxford English Dictionary. I heard this on the Radio 4 news. They said they'd had a cull of obsolete words and Dry Psalter had gone. And I was kind of heartbroken and delighted at the same time. But there is a Dry Psalter's shop in the town next to the town I live in the northwest of England, which tells you something about this town. It's one of the last Dry Psalter's shops left. So a Dry Psalter was a sort of 18th, 19th century domestic high street alchemist. They sold powders and glues and chemicals to gardeners and cooks and so on. And I liked that sense of a sort of domestic alchemist, but I also liked the resonance with the Psalter and the way that the Psalter sits at one remove from the Psalms. So the Psalter, as you know, is a kind of, I suppose, a book that someone would carry around that contains the Psalms, but also contains marginalia and personal notes and local jokes and cartoons going back to the medieval period. So I thought, I can't attempt to claim that I'm writing a Psalter, but I can try and write a Dry Psalter. And as soon as I decided that, I thought, well, there better be 150 poems then. 150 Psalms, 150 poems. And as soon as I decided that, I thought, well, that's a huge book. What unifying factor am I going to have to tie all these together? And I thought, well, I'll give it another twist then and do 15 lines per poem. So this is 150 poems of 15 lines, which is good news for you because you know they're going to end at a certain point. What interested me about that was it's not quite a sonnet. So I've written sonnet sequences before and loved that. But there's something about 15 lines that just trips you out of the familiar pattern of writing a sonnet. So my problem now after 5 years of this is to write a 16th line in a poem again. The poem is bookended with two mirror image poems, one called World into Fragments, and then at the end, one called Fragments into World. So there's a sense in which everything that happens in between is provisional and is broken, takes place, in, I suppose, in a world of brokenness. So I'm going to begin and end the part of the reading now with those poems. And just so you get a sense of the scope of the event, I've been told to read for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes, and then there'll be a chance for us to have a conversation if there's anything you want to ask. World into Fragments. Small breaks first. Cup on marble floor, mirrors on staircase, cracked watch face, hairlines in roof tiles, then it escalates. Plate windows shiver into diamonds. Smoked office towers fold into tobacco heaps. Screens give way to white noise, then blow. Reasons for this shattering include too great a tension, too much shrill, a world more fragile than we thought. Yet still it goes, ear-splitting as great forests disassemble like mosaics. Sugar glass trees turn shingle, then the sky, sun and moon as vast burst bulbs, hot torrential hail. And when it stops, we see for real, as if through mud and spit. Like a lot of families, we've just, my mother's been doing some family history research, going further and further back to try and find somebody who wasn't a Lancashire mill worker. And finally, she did find someone who wasn't a Lancashire mill worker, and this was Captain McMurdo, who was one of the Antarctic explorers, and he has a stretch of water named after him in Antarctica, McMurdo Sound. I've not been to Antarctica, but it's taken on this kind of mythic value in the family because of this tangential link with it. So this is about that mythic Antarctica. Antarctica is sleeping now, its bright fields intercut with suburbs, ordered rows of clapboard homes, pin-sharp backyards all ablaze with jasmine and magnolia. Its citizens are freer than the rest of us, living off star fruit from the ice forests, bleached quails that ripen in the milk orange groves. No one sleeps alone here, and only fishermen dream of wax-white orcas, blind and red-eyed, circling under ice sheets swept by katabatic winds. Of course, this is not true Antarctica, where clutches of tough scientists cross dates off charts. No, this is Alter Antarctica, home to sibling selves. Once a month, they send a greyhound to the brink where ice peters into water. Then the dog pelts back. The time it takes gives them a reading of the future. There are lots of poems about booths in this book. As you can imagine, writing 150 poems, themes start appearing, and then you can either resist them or go with them. And sometimes that was a difficult choice. But this theme of booths seemed fitting. The idea of them as confessionals, obviously, you know, as a Catholic, there's a resonance there for me. But the idea of these multiple secular booths in which you are confronted with yourself. And this is called Hymn to a Photo Booth. Drag the curtain closed. Spin on the seat to raise or lower. Now a head fills the oval. Face to face at last. Eyes meet. So stare. Whoever is this? We oracles do not use names. All answers are generic. Feel for the point where soul meets skull. A bone fuse or knuckle in your neck that keeps you of a piece. Look empty. Never smile. Border guards dislike the imprecision of emotion. Face as wintry landscape. Flash. You have been shot. Now step out. No re-entry. All-seeing eye saw ocular blood clots, sun-blemished skin and a broken heart. Now wait while I spit out your mugshots. One of the themes from the Psalms, from the Psalter, that I think is most difficult, a lot of people who use the Psalms in their own prayer find it difficult, is this theme of the enemy, the other, the foreigner, often described with some venom. And so this sense of the otherness of the others is one of the things that kept coming up for me in writing the poems. And this is one of the poems that attempts to address that. It's called The Others. Other people wake up, wash, blink out at icy wastes or plumes of steam. Some are scared by what they have to do today. They dress in other people's many ways, shirt first, shirt last, no shirt at all, and some resent the clothes they have to wear. If you were there to see them, you would mark the way they thread their buttons through, the moo they give the mirror as they leave. Thoughts of other people are opaque, the weather in their souls a mystery. Some, from restive nights, are slow to rise. Being other, they have not met you yet, but some, with time and chance, could love you, if you would let them get that close. Some of these poems I have to give introductions to, except at Greenbelt, because I can safely assume the title alone will tell you what you need to know. Out of the depths. Have I cried unto you because no pearl diver has ever gone so far on one held breath beyond the seals and filaments of sun, past submarines and oil rig footprints, threaded portholes, iceberg wounds, from twilight to true darkness, down, my torch fails, now my camera floods, and sink to lower midnight sea's abyss, where sight begins to come back, fish ablaze with their own blush and bloom, plunge into trenches less mapped than the solar system, none come back from here, no coming up for air, the water barely molten, and the vast weight of the world borne on the tail flick of a tintless fish. Does the term O song, as in letter O, O songs or O antiphons mean anything to you? It's a liturgical term that applies in Advent. And this is a series of liturgical responses using the titles of Christ. And I decided to write some of these O songs. And one of the titles of Christ that I've always found most compelling was Man of Sorrows. This is O song. O man of sorrows, I missed you as you passed me in the street last night. The wind funneled between buildings, blew grit into my eyes, fine sand miles from the sea. I am so sorry. I stopped to blink and saw a bloom of damson on your linen shirt, a swarm of scarabs on your brow. A staggered gait, as if your boots were not a fit. I knew then it was you, and watched you turn to look at me, to brush your hand across my head, a palm still wet with rain or blood. You said some words I didn't catch, left me lost and shot with longing. I bet you didn't expect me to mention the royal wedding. But this poem came from the royal wedding, indirectly, in that Caroline Duffy, as part of her laureateship, has invited other poets to, so she's not so lonely out there, to respond to some of these big events. And she took a couple of pages in The Guardian and commissioned a number of us to write new wedding vows or relationship vows. And the hook was the royal wedding, but we didn't have to write about the royal wedding, I hasten to add. And this was mine. I've slightly adapted it since it was in The Guardian. As often happens between a newspaper or magazine publication and a book publication, the months that go by make you look back at it and think, actually, I could do better than that. So this is the finished version. The vows. We pledge to wake each morning face to face, to shun the orders of the busy sun. We promise to disturb each other's peace. And we will, yes, gaze at the pining moon. We'll pick out brine-blown glass gems from the strand. We'll read our future scratched onto a stone. We both believe that silence turns to sand and promise not to add to the unsaid. We meet here as the raging sea meets land. We want the risen life before we're dead. Our passion will be squandered more than spent. We hereby swear to spend our days in bed. We're naked till we wear each other's scent and recognize it quicker than our own. You start and finish me. You're my extent. Have you seen Hitchcock's film, The Birds? I imagine most people have. Hitchcockian. The birds are taking over. Not in rows on high wires, chittering on roofs at passers-by, fixing a lone child with their red-ringed sinkhole eyes. Not by massing on our windowsills at dawn and tap, tap, tapping with the urgency, hunger, blunt sense of the wild. not with a skirl and swoop like smoke cut loose from fire, but with a single egg inside each one of us, lodged in the fold between lungs, not felt until the break, la petite mort, when shell cracks and a song begins, an airless, blood-borne trill, a pulse, a stretch of wing, which may be dun wren, bird of paradise, dull rook. And none of us can know what kind is ours, nor even know for sure it's there, this skitter, this arrhythmia, this restlessness, this ache that makes you walk out mid-meal, steal a car, and disappear. Okay. This is... I found myself introducing this poem, saying it's about a tendency in society to reach back to look for some kind of prototype way of living or eating or exercising or conducting relationships. Or, but it's probably about me, if I'm honest. And that yearning that I suppose I recognize as well. It's called The Road Retaken. Walking backwards into the desert, your neck aches from its owl swivel and your calves and ankles seize. You divest yourself of gadgets and accoutrements, then garments, naked for a while until the hair crops up all over. Reversing through suburbs, you bump into signs, parked cars. Some truck near wings you and its driver gives a finger and a blast. So, out. Past flower sellers, fields, then dirt tracks. Cutting up your heels, you crouch, hunch, past the final fruit stall, tidy filling station, hitchhikers with cardboard signs. The shouts and jeers become incomprehensible to you. Keep on is all, until your ragged toes touch sand. You have forgotten all you ever knew, books, doctrines, symphonies, whole cultures are unwritten. That hot breeze tastes of nothing. Turn round, drop to all fours. Now run. One of the blessings or curses of working on such a long book is during the course of the 5 years, you get commissions for particular poems. And then the art is to try to write what you were going to write anyway for the book, but answer the commission as well. And that means the best commissions are the very open-ended ones. And there was a great commission that I had in the middle of this to respond with a short sequence of poems to anything in the program on a particular night from a particular orchestra, and then it would be read out, the poems would be read out at the concert. And so I looked through the program for this particular night, this particular orchestra, and it was Benjamin Britten's setting of the Rambo poems, Les Illuminations, which are weird, strange, surreal poems, beautiful poems. But one of the things that struck me looking at them was Rambo uses this title, The Hotel Splendide, which I thought was splendid. The idea of this Hotel Splendide that he very really leaves alone, mentions and describes very briefly. So that was my starting off point. And I'm going to read a couple of these Hotel Splendide poems now, which fit into Dry Psalter and pick up some of the themes from elsewhere in Dry Psalter. The first poem is called Animal of Light, which is a phrase I've wanted to write about and write into a poem for about 2 or 3 years since I first discovered it. It was Pablo Neruda, the Chilean poet, who was asked in an interview late in life, you know, where do you see yourself now as a poet? And he said, I have become an animal of light, which is a great way of not answering an interviewer's question, but a beautiful idea, the animal of light. So the first of these two Hotel Splendide poems is called Animal of Light. That instant in the Hotel Splendide when you pulled the cord to let that high window help you find your earrings, button up your dress, you loosed into our room an animal of light, a filament so fine and quick you never saw it. One blink, ill-timed, and I had lost it too. I know it came to search us and to show us what we kept unlit, the bruised fist of the heart, its inner walls, a cave art record of the beasts that make us hunted. Elver slim, it slid beneath my skin, rifled through the pockets of my lungs. I coughed, but no, it would not let me be. Worlds away from this, a dog waits in a cold hall, finds the one bright square of sun on tiles, and sleeps in it. And this is called The Night Porter's Promise. Guests returning late will get a clipped good night, a blind eye turned towards that mystery companion. Tables will be laid for morning's conference, clean cups, name tags, branded pens and pads, a whiteboard for the top 10 sales techniques. Beauty, solace, I will find in details. Catch of till screen light on bottled spirits fat-necked in their optics. Swags of laundry-ready sheets like shucked shrouds. Steady hum of aircon's flight through tranquil skies. I pledge to greet the rows of shoes left out to polish with alacrity. I undertake to steer Hotel Splendide through territories of darkness without loss or lack. I swear on the guest book to lay newspapers at every door and waken no one, then to stare into the silent hours until the silent hours stare back. Okay. There's a lot of repeated titles or semi-repeated titles in this book, which again seemed like a way of giving it a kind of internal glue to hold the poems together. And there are a lot of praise songs and there are a lot of hymns. Here's a praise song. Praise song for a blizzard. We give thanks for these vanilla swarms of fat bees, broken from the future back to us. Not simply mute, they push their silence into every corner. Stings are intact still, but quickly pale. Once all the swarms have melted, might a door be left ajar? Will creatures from the yet to be tip up here, unsure of their footing, wincing in the slant sun? A new bird silvers in the black birch. You tramp through thick snow hand in hand with your descendant. And there's much to ask, but she is fey and hungry. And if you speak, she will not understand. Now, if this is a book of psalms, or a book of pseudo-psalms, a book of dry psalms, I thought it needed a psalmist. And in the way that the real psalms have a psalmist, who's actually a mythic figure. As I understand it, most scholarly opinion is that the Psalms were written by multiple hands across quite a span of time. Some of them grew out of a shared tradition, but certainly the idea of an individual author, and that author being King David, seems at least contentious now. But I liked the idea of this mythic psalmist, the single author. And I liked the idea of the connections you could make with the story of David as well. So I'm going to read you a couple of these portraits of a psalmist. Portrait of the psalmist as a man in tears. Or rather, after tears, when all is spent. The bedroom marinated, pools and towels, mist. And Mr. Lacrimose, the cry king, back inside his childhood body, clearer, cleaner, fit to dash full tilt across an open field. Now look, his old self says to him, there's milk in the refrigerator, winds in pines outside, a list pinned up with all the tide times, seize the day, the gift those tears have left, try not to make the same mistakes again. So he stands in the hallway and is calm, the powders of his fear too damp to light. And for the first time yet, he sees the bones that form his soul. a skeleton so strong that he could, does, leave home and start again. And this next one's Portrait of the Psalmist. In utter darkness, not his absence, not his finding himself wept up on some far shore, leaving here an empty frame, life story with hole in the heart. This portrait is left intentionally blank, so you can add your own king, hero, waste of space, a legend in the local sense alone, perhaps, a question where the answers should have been, a heap of clothes draped on a throne, bent crown, a locked, unwindowed, silent room. On trust, we take the presence of a man, the fact that he is crying still, his hands held out to us in desperate supplication. But this anti-incarnation need not keep us, not when you turn aside and see the glory of the lit now, then smell it on your fingers. I'll read another Booth poem, another one of these Booth poems. This is about a hurricane Booth, which you can experience at Chester Zoo. Hymn to a hurricane Booth. I feed it coins, step in, slide shut the glass. I'm in here to be blown away, 120 kph of fun. Press go. My coat bucks like a paper dragon, hands braced on the walls until, unheralded, the storm stills and holds me in its eye. Pulse loosens, deepens to a bass drum. And outside the Booth, the world accelerates. Shops change hands, close down. The mall streams taillight trails from days, months, years. My kids point, laugh, then jitter, grow, and leave. If my heart could race, it would. But no, I'm silk passed through the tempest's eye. And though I know my money buys a minute, this feels like a lifetime's reckoning. I vow to change, then step out into silence. Here's a love poem. There are some love poems in this book. Some odder than others. This is a moderately odd love poem. A dog heard but not seen. Utterly alone, it barks through the night in a backyard across town and steals your sleep from you. As respite from the future and its fears, you call the roll of enemies, friends, lovers, and pray for them. Then one by one hold each up to your inner light until a face comes clear. You pray it matters to be held so still, and that someone holds you somewhere. The dog begins to holler like a wolf, then silence overwhelms it and it stops. Absence seems a presence in itself. All the while I'm lost to you in sleep. I am not with you when you need me most, and the climb to dawn is long and steep. Okay. You're working very hard down here, you know, much harder than I am. Okay. Here's another love poem. While we're on love poems, this is a slightly less odd one. Soul Song. The countless pinprick points of light that make us human also map us. So if I looked at you in love, complete in utter darkness, I would see a swarm of fireflies, carriers of every half-formed thought, your history. And with each breath and kiss, your filigree of sparks would cloud and cross with mine. Except, of course, no room is ever night enough. No dark can be so utter as to let us see this. But feel the hairs lift on your neck, their static charge, and know that we have met our souls, invisible but physical, akin to gale force, thunder, gravity. In the course of these 5 years, I've been working on this book, one of the things that happened, as you've probably noticed, is that the economy collapsed. The language of that, particularly that all this new language of recession and finance started to creep into all our heads, I think, and so it started to creep into the poems as well. And then, in one news bulletin, I heard the suggestion that the nation should create a bad bank. Like they weren't bad enough, but this is a technical, a bad bank to take our toxic debts. So this is a poem about that. It's called The Offset. I set up a bad bank to protect me from my toxic debts, the unthanked, double-crossed omissions and commissions. Rows of bad tellers slump behind glass, drumming their fingers. Sun through tall windows crosses the spotless floor. Bad guards play poker in the vaults where my net worth is kept in a time-locked safe and non-performing assets float in jars. In his upstairs office, my bad manager weeps into his coffee for his lost career. He did nothing to deserve this, poor soul. Yet still he wears a sharp tie, keeps cut flowers, thumbs through his empty diary, gazes out at oblivious and solvent passers-by. This is another Booth poem. An automatic soothsayer Booth. Have you seen these at funfairs? No. Automatic soothsayer Booth. Your custom is my pleasure, now look into my eyes. Destino reads your fortune like a mortal reads a book. I cannot be held liable for heartbreak or surprise. The road ahead is twisted, so you may not want to look. This turban should be ochre, but will pale a shade each year. My beard was once a boot brush, my cloak a velvet drape. I come not from the mystic east, but from a cold north pier. My utterance is Orphic, my voice a loop of tape. I'm half a man, so legless, a torso on a plank. My name is not Destino, but your own name in reverse. Your next decade is joyful, and your wife's the one to thank. From then on, it's a nightmare, I'm sorry to be terse. I'd make the most of winters, but stay out of the sun. Drink more milk than whiskey, never race a hearse. Don't invest in futures, and remember, life is fun. Okay. Probably got time for... Let's do three or four others. Okay. The End of Civilization as We Know It. Another title I've been waiting to write a poem for a long time. Right now, a hound dreams on a porch overlooking endless desert. No one can tell the content of his dreams, but watching, we might wonder from the flicker of his eyelids if he sees a jackrabbit squat by the scrub's edge, taut and taunting him, spring-loaded. Or the pulse in his haunches means a hurtle down a long straight road behind his man's accelerating pickup. But what if these are mere nerve ticks without cause or meaning, and the dream is less a story than a place, less place than state, an openness through which the wilderness will pour itself, a foothold, first step to our towns, our homes, the crack that lets the desert in. The mirror test. The mirror test, probably some of you know this, is a test of, consciousness, and is used with various species to establish whether they are conscious and specifically self-conscious. So you put a mark on a creature's face and stick it in front of a mirror and see whether it responds with a paw or wing or whatever in such a way that suggests it knows this is its own face. This is the mirror test. They bring us one by one to face the glass, having marked us each with blank ink crosses on the cheek. First, bonobos pass, orangutans, then elephants and magpies, self-awareness vivid in their angst about this new scar, testing it with tongue, trunk, wing. Me now. I stare into a temperate and muted world, wall with posters in a foreign script, tall windows, mountains rising to a coast. And in the middle of that other room, a man is buttoned up inside a woman's coat, his face marked like mine for some unstated sin, but on the other cheek. He pities me, leans in as if to speak, but before a word is said, they fail me. Send me back into the jungle. Okay. Two more. Again, I don't think I need to introduce this one to you. A new song. Sing a new song to the Lord. Sing through the skin of your teeth. Sing in the code of your blood. Sing with a throat full of earth. Sing to the quick of your nails. Sing from the knots of your lungs. Sing like a dancer on coals. Sing as a madman in tongues. Sing as if singing made sense. Sing in the caves of your heart. Sing like you want them to dance. Sing through the shades of your past. Sing what you never could say. Sing at the fulcrum of joy. Sing without need of reply. And I'll finish with the last poem where we put the fragments back together, fragments into world. Thank you very much for listening so patiently. And after this poem, I think there's the opportunity for us to have a conversation if you would like that. And there'll be a microphone if you want to ask anything. Fragments into world. A note resolves. Hum becomes chime. The floor stirs and broken moon is combed from shattered sun in utter darkness. Then, like wrong rain, it falls up, gathers in the sky. Sunlit now, we see the devastation, watch as windows heal and pull together. Towers, palaces, museums rear up, dripping from the dry sea of themselves. Forests fan like spines from sharp seeds. Then the details. Clock faces turn limpid. Cups and mirrors form and seal. A recapitulation of the world we knew. So once again we walk and witness. Give thanks for the tangible and visible. But no one dares to sing a note. Dig in a heel.
Thank you so much, Michael. That was absolutely wonderful. Do we have any questions? Sorry. Andy.
Thanks, Michael. That was terrific. You are responding to the Psalms, and the Psalms we think of in some ways as praise that argues with God.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that you are arguing either with God or with the Psalms or the psalmist?
I think all of the above. Some some are very much, I think, I mean, this is my sixth book, and I think there's always been that element of arguing or wrestling with God in my poems. But I think probably there's a wider range of that sort of argument or discussion or a quest for understanding going on. And that's partly because, yes, the Psalms are there as well. So it's the Psalms, the notion of the psalmist and who that would be, the authority that comes from that, and how I respond to that. And yes, a lot of it's arguing with myself. I think the idea of those Booth poems is, you know, what happens if the whole of lyric poetry is built on the I look at this, I see that, and that that I is not quite the same as the poet, but in some ways a persona that the poet steps into and out of, then I was interested to see what would happen if you put that I in certain tight spots, you know, put it in a booth, a photo booth, and see what happens to it. So yes, the Psalms are a significant sort of conversational partner, I think, in the poems. But the poems, I should have said this at the beginning, the poems don't map onto the Psalms psalm by psalm in the sense that poem 7 maps onto it's not like that. It's more a negotiation and argument with the themes in the Psalms and the voices in the Psalms, I think.
Are there any other questions?
Hi, Michael. Thank you again. So I just wondered about the structure. You know, you were saying about this, and I know you've just been saying that too. So at what point does the structure take over the book? And do you see what I mean? Is it an organic thing, or did you really sit down and say, right, 150, 150, okay, let's do that? And, you know, was it very clear-cut? Or, you know, were you like, I don't know, 10 poems in, you realise, oh, I've got something going here, and proceeding like that, because you know your other books also, Corpus and so on,
yes,
have these kind of thematic things which are, as it were, pulse through, you know, and that's you know what you do.
I think I kind of wish that I could write a book of poems that was like my first two books of poems, which were individual poems, and you write enough until you've got a book, and then I find I can't do that anymore. I get too interested in the overall architecture of the book, and I think that's probably an affliction I picked up from my day job for a while was as a BBC producer making radio documentaries and then documentary films. So you would go into an edit with all this material that you'd shot, and you'd have to make a shape out of it. And I think after doing that for a few years, I got stuck with it. So now, you described it very well. You know, you're 10 poems in or something, and the poems are coming, and they seem to be circling around certain themes. And then you think, I'm now going to start to think about the bigger shape. And the first year of this was quite a struggle, I found, trying to find what that shape would be. And then keeping on being pulled back to the Psalms and the Psalter, and driving past this silly little shop with dry salt written on it, and not quite being able to forget the word, and then thinking, well, if I'm going to take this seriously, I've got to write 150 of these, and how's that going to work, and can I find enough variety within the 150, and if I set 15 lines, how much variety is there in that? And in actual fact, as you know from your own writing, there's a huge amount of variety in any line extent, you know. So 15 lines can be 3 5 line stanzas, or 5 3 line stanzas, or you can split it in the middle almost like a sonnet, or you can have them as couplets with a single line at the end. So you can play any number of tunes. They can be rhymed or half rhymed or unrhymed. So it felt once I'd got the shape, quite liberating. It was the liberation that comes through constraint. You know, every time you settle to write a poem, there's one question you don't have to ask, which is, how long is this going to be? Yeah.
I've got a question. You mentioned a couple of times that you didn't need to introduce poems to us because of the makeup of the audience. And I'm just wondering, for people who maybe are not that familiar with the Psalms, how do you feel that your work speaks to them, this particular collection, and certain resonances that might be missed? I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this question, but I just wondered.
No, it's really interesting that. I suppose like anyone who writes and is writing from the perspective of faith within a faith tradition, you struggle with language that to you is very familiar and very resonant and actually doesn't connect at all in the wider culture potentially. And so for me, I always assume that most of the people who read my books or buy my books know nothing of, have no sense of the Christian tradition or the language of Christianity. So although I will use that language, I always try to use it in a way that doesn't rely on a whole set of cultural assumptions that you've had because you've been to church for years. So it's important to me that literature is a secular space. I mean, we could talk about this all night, but literature is a secular space in that it goes out into a culture where it can't make assumptions about people sharing values. And the great Anglo-Welsh poet and artist David Jones, 60 years ago, wrote about this in a Christian context and said, what do you do as a poet if you're trying to express Christian faith and you use a word like water and you know that the audience is diminishing, that will know that you're hinting at baptism? Or will you use a word like wood and the proportion of the audience is diminishing that will get that as a reference to the cross? So he was saying the resonance of a metaphor about water or wood for a Christian poet is diminished because that kind of people don't have that hinterland anymore. And that's in the 1950s. So now that's so much more radically true, I think. So I think it's exciting that you have to remake the metaphors. But I don't think it doesn't feel right or interest me as a poet to try to just shape the familiar language of my own Christianity and make beautiful objects out of it, because I feel I need to enter this secular space where a poem exists and try to make something as profound as I can within that space. Sorry, that was waffly, but did it make any...
Hi, did your views of the Psalms change as you wrote your own poems?
I think inevitably, but not straightforwardly, in the sense that it wasn't a sort of a straightforward shift that I could sum up and say to you, I found them more this or less that. I found them more various even than I had thought before, and more troubling actually. And bleaker in places, and the praise that's there very vividly in the Psalms is always hard won. I found them full of conflict and honesty as well as beauty, so I found them extraordinary. And one of the things that changed my perspective was not so much directly writing the poems, but was discovering a new set of translations of the Psalms in the process of writing the book, which were by Robert Alter, the New York-based Hebrew scholar who'd a couple of years ago published a complete new set of translations of the Psalms. And the reason was he felt they had left the body behind, that the imagery of the body, which is very, very vividly there in the Hebrew texts, has been softened and taken more into abstract territory from the King James Bible on. And he acknowledges the beauty of the King James Bible, but says ever since then, we've got further and further away from the physicality. He uses examples like, the word soul actually being the word throat, or something like throat in the original Hebrew. And he wants to get back to the physicality of the Psalms. And that had quite an effect on me as someone who, as you could probably tell, kind of has... the imagery of the body, slightly gruesome imagery of the body, tends to recur in my work anyway. There's a sort of fascination with where personal identity lies, I think, and how far you are your body. And so those sorts of themes, suddenly discovering these new psalms by this scholar that changed that perspective back towards the body, was quite revelatory for me.
This is a question aimed at you wearing your professorial hat.
about the state of poetry in society at the moment and the trends. Just anecdotally, I just sort of feel things are a bit flat, and then suddenly in Manchester we have the Mask of Anarchy, and there's a fantastic fuss and everything else about that. So I just wonder from your perspective where you think we are.
And poetry refuses to go away. It's constantly described as marginalised, as a marginal to the culture, and it is marginal to the culture in the sense that people who'd be embarrassed to be at a dinner party and not have read the latest Martin Amis novel don't feel at all embarrassed about not having read the latest Seamus Heaney or Lavinia Greenlaw. So there is definitely a sense of it not being an essential part of most, even quite bookish people's diet to read. On the other hand, it won't go away, and as a culture, at moments where, this is the Poet Laureate's role, but it's more than the Poet Laureate's role, at moments where we as individuals or as a society feel under severe pressure or duress, or feel that something significant enough has happened that you need a form of language to mark it, you don't reach for a novel. At a memorial service, you very rarely get an extract from a novel read out. It's poetry. It's the particular concentrated power that poets have always aspired to write. Same with weddings, moments of love. I mean, you'll know the Manchester Evening News, you pick it up every night, there are these homespun elegies in two or three lines. People who've never written a poem before, but because their father's died or their child, they want to honour that, and they reach for poetry and try to write something because it feels that only that will do. So it's complicated. I'm always wary of rumours of a sort of revival about to happen in poetry. I'm not sure it will ever happen in that sense, but I don't think it will ever go away. And we have, travelling around Europe and talking to poets in other countries, there's a definite sense that we're better off than a lot of them, partly because of things like the BBC, radio, huge amount of poetry on radio compared with any other European broadcaster. So it's not going anywhere. I don't think it's about to peter out. And I think there's a great quote Seamus Heaney used years ago in an interview. He said, the thing about poetry as an art form is it's never been fully secularized. And I think that's true. So that's the flip side to what I was saying about literature being a secular space. I think it is. I think the published world of literature in Waterstones is a secular space if ever there was one. But the act of writing poetry and using poetry at an event or to mark an occasion is far from secular.
Time for one more question.
Hi. This is in no way a technical question, but I just wanted to say how you've given my mind a jolt to start Greenbelt, and thank you for that.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you.